This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is it. The climate shift has come. Ice melt in the Himalayas has doubled just since the year 2000. We get the latest from Dr. Summer Ruper. That comes partly from continued warming of what has been called the Earth's third pole. In the Arctic, Greenland is melting fast, making sea level rise a stunning 80% over previous estimates. The Washington Post reports, quote, "The extent of ice cover over the Arctic Ocean has never been this low in mid-June during the age of weather satellites. Greenland saw temperatures soar up to 40 degrees above normal Wednesday, while open water exists in places north of Alaska where it seldom, if ever, has in recent times." End quote. Record heat is driving snow from the Arctic lands and ice from the glaciers right into the ocean. It is all part of the single biggest impact of climate change on civilization, rising seas. Oceanographer and rising seas expert John Englander will be our feature interview in this program. The climate disruption predicted back in the 1990s is definitely here. The long time of struggle, deaths, trying to adapt, suffering, and extreme weather has begun to arrive. My listeners in the Midwest states and New England know it. Last week, a month's worth of rain fell one night in New Jersey, and that's just part of the 2 months of repeating floods from Houston all the way to New England, colder weather, tornadoes, and unsettling times over the eastern U.S. The West has been baking in heat, bracing for the next big fires. In Europe, AccuWeather says, millions to swelter as heat wave builds from Madrid to Paris, London, next week. The whole of North Africa is over 40 degrees C, building to 50 in places. The same for the Middle East. There is a band of high heat from the Caspian Sea to northern China with high temperatures in Siberia. But my personal turning point was the mega heat wave that just hit the continent of India. The monsoon rains are finally arriving in southern India, almost 2 weeks late. The rains that literally feed India are becoming less dependable and weaker. The one in 2015 was a bust. While waiting for this year's monsoon, the major city of Chennai, formerly known as Madras, went dry. The government had to truck in water nonstop for over 6 million residents. Millions of villagers in many parts of India had to leave their dry wells and their homes for help elsewhere. They are climate refugees within their own country. 35 major dams went bone dry. They left without food in the deadly heat, hovering in the mid-40s C, over 110 degrees Fahrenheit. At least 100 people died in the eastern state of Bihar alone. India will half recover as the monsoon replenishes the reservoirs, we trust. But officials predict another dry season, hurting food production for 1.3 billion people. Millions of poor people have suffered in that heat. Some will not return home. They are losing their faith not just in the monsoons, but in the future. There will be lasting hurt from this one, and a growing weakness for the next great heat waves as they come in the years. People in other parts of the world do not know this turning point just happened. That is just the start for India's water woes, of course. Al Jazeera reported on June 20th, quote, "At least 21 cities in India, including capital New Delhi, Bengaluru, Chennai, and Hyderabad, will run out of groundwater by 2020, affecting around 100 million people. India's news network NDTV said 40% of India's population will have no access to drinking water by 2030, according to a report by the National Institution for Transforming India, known as AIOG, the country's principal planning organization, end quote. The recent record heat wave did stretch right into the Tibetan Plateau. Arctic blogger Sam Karana frightened me with this tweet, quote, Temperature of 49.8 degrees C or 121.6 degrees Fahrenheit forecast for Lhasa, Chengguan in Tibet on June 22, 2019. But on June 22, the temperature in Lhasa was nothing like that. It was more a humble 26 degrees C or 80 degrees Fahrenheit. That is because the climate reanalyzer site SAM uses cannot really focus at the city level. It uses models with a very big scale, without reference to local conditions. Be careful of predictions and check if they come true in reality. But it was abnormally hot in Tibet. Back in 2009, Chinese climatologists reported temperatures at 29 monitoring sites in Tibet showed an average increase of 1.5 degrees C even then. It's hotter now in both summer and winter. That is new because previous warming in the Himalayas was recorded in winter only. The big shift is backed by new science showing a doubling in the rate of ice melting from the Himalayan glaciers, and that is next.
Radio EcoShock.
New science reports ice loss from glaciers in the mighty Himalayas have doubled since the year 2000 due to global heating. That could affect up to a billion people downstream and add to rising sea levels around the world. On June 19th, four scientists published their paper, Acceleration of Ice Loss Across the Himalayas Over the Last 40 Years. Here to help us is co-author Dr. Summer Ruper, associate professor in the Geography Department at the University of Utah from Salt Lake City. Summer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
How substantial is the amount of ice in the Himalayas?
So we don't actually know the exact volume of ice in the Himalayas. We know that the Himalayas hosts more snow and ice than any region outside of the polar regions. But the exact volume is still uncertain because it's difficult to see to the bed or to, you know, the rock beneath the ice itself. What we do know is that they are significant contributors to water resources for populations living downstream.
We know the Arctic is far hotter. Are the great mountains along China and India heating up in a similar way?
They are. In fact, one of the things we did is compile weather station data from across the Tibetan Plateau, the High Himalayas, and across the entire region, everything that was available. And what we can see is over at least the last 40 to 50 years, there's been a significant increase and accelerating increase in temperatures in the high mountain regions.
Yes, they just had a heat wave in northern India. I'm sure that extended into Tibet. And the Chinese were saying as long ago as 2009 that Tibet was heating up much more than expected.
Yeah, the rate of warming seems to be accelerating, and this is actually somewhat similar to what we're seeing in a lot of high mountain regions, and that is the warming seems to be amplified at higher elevations than down lower, actually. And there's quite a bit of work trying to understand why that is the case, but we know it is certainly happening, and that really does put these high mountain systems at risk from climate change.
Summer, please take whatever time you need to describe how your team determined the rate of loss in the Himalayas has doubled since the year 2000.
One of the difficult things in the Himalayas is that it's simply so remote, right? It's extremely hard to get there. Once you do get in, it's really difficult working environment. There's safety issues. It can be difficult to even access some glaciers because they sit at politically controversial borders, things like that. So there's very limited sort of boots on the ground filled evidence for what's happening on glaciers. There is some, and the evidence that we have from field observations do show that these glaciers have been shrinking or retreating, getting smaller over time, but these are, you know, very limited numbers of glaciers, and there are thousands of glaciers in the Himalayas, and it's a very complex region, so it always begs the question of how representative is a single glacier of this much, much larger region. When looking at the larger region, we typically rely on remote imagery, like from satellites. And most of the work that's been done is use these modern-day satellites, really the last decade or so. But in terms of either glacier or climate change, that's a really short period of time. So we've utilized those as well, but what we really wanted to do is get much further back where we could see what's really happening, what do the trends really look like, and how does that compare to what climate system has been doing. And so what we ended up doing was tapping into these historical spy satellite images that were just recently declassified. These were satellites that were launched in the 1970s as part of the, you know, the height of the Cold War era, with the really the sole goal of peering over the Iron Curtain. It was, I've heard it described as these being similar to a 1970s version of Google Earth, right? You had near global coverage of images from the 1970s. But what's unique about these images is that they're overlapping. So you have essentially a view of the Earth in stereo. So we can use these stereo images to reconstruct the three-dimensional surface of the Earth from the 1970s. This was a difficult task. Typically what people had been doing was processing these images manually, which is incredibly time-consuming and also wrought with uncertainty at times, especially in the Himalayas, because the manual method requires lining these images up with known sort of GPS points, so a road intersection where you know exactly where it is in space and its exact elevation. But in the Himalayas, you don't have a lot of man-made structures. A lot of time has passed in 40 or 50 years, so a lot of erosions, landslides. So one of the things my former student did and lead author on this paper was develop a new algorithm where we could automatically process these stereo images. And this allowed us to sweep across the entire Himalayan range, capturing glaciers from east to west across a 2,000 kilometer, more than 1,200 miles of landscape, and look at how glaciers have been changing, not just in terms of the area that they cover, but the actual volume of ice that has been lost from the 1970s all the way to present.
But there could be other factors, as you talk about in your paper. Industrialization in Asia has deposited black carbon, which attracts more heat, and the monsoons, as we know, have decreased somewhat in recent years. Maybe there's less precipitation in the mountains to form ice. How do you know these are not the cause of the new melt rate instead of global warming?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, the thing to make clear is that these things do affect the glaciers, right? If we change the amount of snowfall falling on a glacier, it will change its mass and its size. But the trends in precipitation are not consistent across the full range of the Himalayas, right? The western Himalayas are dominated by westerly storm tracks, not the monsoon, for example, whereas the eastern Himalayas, most of the precipitation coming in is actually coming in the summertime due to monsoonal rains. But the reality is, precipitation trends across the Himalayas is not consistent. It hasn't been decreasing everywhere, so that's very unlikely to be the cause. The second thing with the aerosols is that's equally heterogeneous, right? It's not something that's happening across the entire range of the Himalayas for all glaciers, and we are seeing mass loss of all different types of glaciers across the entire span of the Himalayas. But the clearest way for us to show what the driving force was is that, you know, we know how much energy it takes to melt ice. And so what we can do is we can say, well, how much temperature does temperature have to change to melt the volume of ice that we've seen lost over this period of time? And when we do that calculation, that number matches very closely. It's actually right in the same range as what we're actually observing from the weather stations. So what that's saying is not that, you know, these other things like industrialization and essentially air pollution, you know, and these dark particles from dust and black carbon getting on the glaciers, they can have an effect, and changes in precipitation can have effect. But temperature over this period has just dominated the changes. It's overwhelming everything.
Now, I would have said more water coming from the mountains would be a benefit to farmers and cities downstream in Tibet or China or India, but your paper also mentions, quote, increasing risk of outburst floods due to expansion of unstable proglacial lakes. What is that about, and has it happened already?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'd like to address both those points. So one, what happens immediately is as a glacier thins and retreats, the water tends to, a lot of the water, not all of it, but some of the water pools and lakes at the terminus of the glacier, and it's dammed by these just very tenuous rocky rubble moraines left behind by the glaciers. And what happens is these dams can breach, and you get these massive outburst floods downstream, and it's steep topography, right? So it doesn't take much water to have a really impactful flood. And what we've seen across the Himalayas is as these glaciers are shrinking, the number and size of these glacial lakes is increasing. And we have seen several outburst floods, and these are incredible hazards for the people and the infrastructure downstream of these glaciers. And it's also, I think, worth noting that not always but often these mountain communities are some of the poorer communities of our world. And so these impacts are also, they're very vulnerable because they don't have the resources to essentially address these issues on their own. And the second issue is that as these glaciers respond to climate change, we do start to flood the rivers with more and more water. But what happens is as the glaciers continue to shrink or get smaller, at some point the size becomes so small that you actually hit what's called peak water, where you now no longer continue to increase the amount of water entering the river system. You actually decrease it, and you start to head towards less and less water entering these river systems downstream. And so the long-term prospect of glacier change is actually a significant decrease in glacier meltwater feeding these river systems.
According to the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, more sea level rise is coming from mountain glaciers than from melting ice sheets in the Arctic or in Antarctica. I find that a remarkable fact. I don't think many people know that. So this ice loss in high mountain Asia will affect coastlines around the world.
It will, and it will continue to do so as long as we continue on the path we're on. So these mountain glaciers, because they do respond very quickly to changes in climate in comparison to the big ice sheets, over the next 100 years, they will be, you know, the dominant contributor to sea level rise other than, you know, expansion due to warming of the oceans itself. So the mountain glaciers will continue to contribute more to sea level rise, and the rate at which we melt these glaciers will directly impact the rate at which sea level rises.
In 2010, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change withdrew a prediction that glaciers in the Himalayas could disappear by the year 2035. But could some glaciers disappear there, and can we estimate when?
So the mistake in the IPCC report was that it essentially said that we would lose all glaciers by 2035, which scientists immediately said that's not accurate. What we are seeing is that the rate of loss is accelerating and will continue to accelerate. We will certainly lose, and we have lost, some glaciers already in high mountain Asia or in the Himalayas. What we're hoping is that this new data set actually gives us more confidence in projections, because it will provide a data set by which we can contest the validity of our glacier models. Right now, the projections for 2100 are that we could lose anywhere between 30 and 70% of the glacier ice in the Himalayas. Even at that low end, that's a very significant loss. At the high end, that is, well, it's very detrimental to ecosystems and populations relying on those glaciers. And so we're hoping what will happen is that this new data set will help us narrow that range of projections a little bit and decrease the uncertainty in our expected response of these glaciers to future climate change.
Dr. Ruper, how does ice loss in the Himalayas compare to the more famous shrinking alpine glaciers in the European Alps?
It's a little bit slower. It follows the same trend in terms of, or the pattern. What we've seen is that in the Alps, mass ice loss has been accelerating over time, and we're seeing that in the Himalayas as well. The Himalayas are a bit lower latitude, and they're much, much higher, so they're much colder. So they're a little bit behind the Alps glaciers in terms of the magnitude of mass loss, but that's unlikely to stay true at this pace.
You just said 30 to 70% ice loss in the Himalayas, if I heard you correctly, by the year 2100. That's an astounding mass. That could possibly change the wobble of the Earth or the location of the poles or something big like that?
No, I mean, the mass of ice, in by comparison to, say, the lithosphere or the solid rock underneath, is actually still quite small. What it can do, though, is have interesting fingerprints on sea level rise. So we tend to think of sea level rise as being, if you throw water in, you get equal rise everywhere, but that's not actually how it works. Because the mass of, say, something like Antarctica has a gravitational pull on sea level, losing mass from a place like Antarctica would then mean that you have less of a pull on sea level rise. Sea level in that region, you can actually have a lowering there, which just then enhances sea level rise other places. So the idea is that as we lose mass from one region, it changes essentially the fingerprint of sea level rise all over the globe in very complex ways. So it's actually, you will see global sea level rise, but some regions will feel it more than others.
If the rate of ice loss in the Himalayan glaciers has doubled since the year 2000, is it possible it could increase or even double again if our greenhouse gases continue to increase as they're doing now?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. That's a distinct possibility. It's one of these questions where as temperatures warm, ice responds immediately, right? Same as our snowpack, right? As from year to year, when temperatures start to get warmer, snow starts to melt, right? And it melts faster and faster as it gets warmer and warmer. Ice does the same thing. The difference with ice is it's dynamic. It's a flowing, moving body, and so it also has a geometric response to that change in ice. So as we lose ice, the glacier tends to thin, but then it slowly starts to change its geometry and retreat. And the actual pace of that mass loss depends on both climate and the time scale it takes a glacier to actually change its shape. And that becomes a very interesting scientific problem. But it means that effectively that rate of mass loss depends on two things. And it'll likely continue to accelerate for some period of time. And then the rate of ice loss will slow down a bit as these glaciers get quite a bit smaller.
Is there good cooperation between Chinese and Indian scientists working on this problem?
Between individual scientists, I think so, right? As a group, it becomes very difficult just because of some of the political tensions that occur between these different groups. So individual scientists try hard to collaborate and work together where they can, but that's not always possible depending on the politics at that moment in time. So it's limited, but that's driven more by the larger governmental politics and not so much by the desires of the individual scientists in those countries.
What research would you like to see done next?
I would really like us to really pin down the impacts of changes in glaciers on water resources for individual communities across the Himalayan range, because that will vary from one place to the next. In some regions, changes in glaciers may have a much smaller impact than others, and I think understanding when and where these changes will have the biggest impacts on these mountain communities is incredibly valuable information and I think would be a really good path forward.
Bottom line, Summer, as we wrap up here, can we now say with confidence that global warming is accelerating glacier melt in the high mountains of Asia?
Undoubtedly, yes.
From the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, we've been speaking with Dr. Summer Ruper. She is co-author of the new study, Acceleration of Ice Loss Across the Himalayas Over the Last 40 Years. You can find links to the full text of the paper and press coverage in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I know you have been swamped with media requests. Summer, thank you for sharing time with our listeners.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm sure you got that from this interview. While the big ice on Greenland and Antarctica will redraw the coastlines all over the world, the first big storm surge waters and street flooding will come instead from land-based glaciers from the Andes to the Rockies, Alps, and Himalayas. Studies show they are disappearing fast as subtropical lands heat up the smaller ice glaciers. In a weird twist, sea levels near the shrinking ice sheets at the poles, like Greenland or Antarctica, may actually go down as gravitational mass is lost, the new waters will appear elsewhere, from the drowning Pacific Islands to flooding swamplands in Louisiana. It's a topsy-turvy map that needs to be redrawn with every generation. The sea is not level. There is no sea level. Now we will go in depth what to expect as the new hot ocean overflows into our ports, airports, cities, and fields.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Please don't forget to support Radio EcoShock. Help pay those bills. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or at our show blog at ecoshock.info.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Several scientists on Radio EcoShock warned us that heat and extreme weather are serious, they can be deadly, but rising seas will be the force threatening society. Maps will change, populations will be forced away from the current seashore, including in major cities around the world. I understood that more deeply watching a recent video presentation by John Englander. His audience was the legendary Royal Institution in London, the Temple of Science, founded in 1799. Englander is the oceanographer who has led big-name ocean conservation groups. He schooled us all with his book, High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level, and the Coming Coastal Crisis. We last talked in October 2016. John Englander, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be with you, Alex.
You have been touring, telling thousands of people, really, about coastlines going underwater. Do you think the broader public really gets it, what a relentless rising sea means for us all?
A little better than perhaps when we talked, but no, I think that most people are confused. They've heard lots of bad information, and frankly, our time horizons as a human civilization is pretty short. I notice a growing awareness, but I would have to say it's still down there in the single-digit percentages.
Okay, well, here's the constant question I'll bet you're always asked. How much will sea level rise and when? John, do we have good answers?
Yeah, that is probably the most common question, so you're absolutely right. We don't have a good answer, but the reason is surprising, and it's that we have potentially 200 feet of sea level rise of all the ice melted on Antarctica and Greenland. That's not going to happen for centuries, maybe 500 years, maybe thousands of years. The question is, how much could melt by the year 2050 or the year 2100? And there's no definitive answer, because it's like predicting when the next San Francisco earthquake will happen, or when the next mudslide will happen, or the next avalanche. Those kind of shifts of earth mass or mud or glaciers are not predictable to the normal standard. It's like saying, when will the next Category 5 hurricane happen? We can't even predict that months in advance. And with sea level, it's usually a slow change. It's usually over centuries or thousands of years, actually, as the ice sheets change. What's happening now is happening in warp speed. It's happening very quickly. And so when we get to the question of how much could sea level rise in the next year, the truth is it's a fraction of an inch. But because of the accelerating melt of the glaciers and ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica, the two places that hold 98% of the ice on the planet and therefore potential sea level rise, the fact is, by the end of the century, we could be looking at 5 or 10 feet of sea level rise. We can't know the answer more precisely any more than somebody could tell you when the next major earthquake will happen in San Francisco. It seems surprising. It may seem like, well, we just don't know enough. But the truth is, those big shifts of earth and those big shifts of ice miles deep or high do not model to the normal precision that we would like to have. No matter how much you know about this subject, and I think I know as much as most, plan for the first 3 feet of sea level rise as soon as possible. And that simple guideline actually is very helpful. If it happens by 2060, we'll be prepared. If it doesn't happen until 2100, we have a little extra time.
Yeah, I think that uncertainty is why groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and some governments just discount rising seas because, well, if you can't give me a hard answer, how am I supposed to plan for that?
That's right. But, you know, we do it with that's why I like to use the analogies, which we normally don't do in science because they're never perfect. But the analogy of predicting the next earthquake, the next avalanche in the mountains, or the next mudslide, you know, in an area that was prone to it, we accept our inability to predict those things. And yet, we plan for the worst case. We plan for the worst hurricane. We plan for a Category 8 earthquake. You know, San Francisco is a great example. We know from the 1906 earthquake that the fault lines go right through the city pretty much. But the planning, what they do right now is, even with all the strain gauges monitoring the fault lines, they plan on a Category 8 earthquake within 50 years having a 10% chance of probability. But we design for that worst case now, and we need to start doing the same thing for sea level rise, because it will be feet higher. We just don't know how soon.
Experts report unstoppable melting of some glaciers in both Greenland and Antarctica. Is that the main source of rising seas, or what about thermal expansion?
Well, in the last century, this is why it gets confusing. Thermal expansion, just warming seawater, which is more than 2 miles deep as a global average, that has been about half the sea level rise in the last century, about 4 or 5 inches. And so that leads people to think that that's a major cause. And again, it was significant in the last century. But moving ahead, because of the glaciers that we're now tracking in Greenland and Antarctica, as you mentioned, which hold many, many feet of sea level rise. I mean, it's easy to find 10 feet of sea level rise in just 6 glaciers in Antarctica, so 3 meters. And sometime this century, we're going to have more than a meter of sea level rise. So the thermal expansion was significant looking back the last century, but in the coming 100 years, it will be relatively minor stuff compared to the melting of those glaciers.
People I talk to about this, just on the street, they think sea level rise will hit Bangladesh or the Pacific Islands maybe, but it won't be a big deal for people in North America or Europe or even Australia, because we can always deal with it. What do you say?
Yeah, I don't know what the psychological thing is we all do, but we tend to say we're immune. You know, it's kind of like getting older. You know, I'm not going to get older. Everybody else does. And the fact is, sea level rise is going to hit every coastal community in the world. So when they say it's a Miami problem or a New York City problem because they're thinking of the storm, you know, Hurricane Sandy, I like to say it's not only Bangladesh and Vietnam. It's San Francisco Bay. It's Boston. It's Jacksonville, Florida, and Tampa, not just Miami. It's 10,000 coastal communities. In fact, it's essentially every community that touches the ocean, not just on the coast, but up tidal rivers, so like Washington, D.C., London, England, and Sacramento, or none of them are on the ocean, but they're all on tidal rivers, and those will flood. And then up through marshlands, like Louisiana and Mississippi, and up through the Carolinas, all those marshes will be affected as sea level rises foot by foot. So, yes, people tend to think it's a Miami and New York problem, but 10,000 coastal communities would be more accurate.
Well, and of course, you could be in the interior of the United States or of China and say, well, it's not going to affect me. But look, if these big coastal cities have to be replaced with all their infrastructure, the economic damage, we got 50% of the population of the United States lives within a few miles of the coastlines. Everybody's going to be hit by this as it happens, I think.
Absolutely true. And on top of that, even if you live 1,000 miles inland and mile high, like Geneva or Denver, your goods still come through ports. And if the ports have been put underwater and the global supply chain is interrupted, anybody that thinks they're unaffected by rising sea level, you know, hasn't looked at the globe recently. Most of our goods come by ship, and the functionality of not only the ports, but the infrastructure, the highways and the railroads that all terminate at ports, you know, bring this issue to every community on Earth.
So there is an institute for practically everything, but apparently none yet dedicated to the single largest threat we face from climate change, the rising seas. So you, John, just founded the International Sea Level Institute. What should it do?
Well, thank you for asking, and thank you for being aware. Actually, last week I was in Puerto Rico talking to them about a regional office for this to help them put this into practical terms for how they should begin adapting. And next week I'll be in London, England, actually up in the Midlands for their annual coast and flooding conference, talking to them about the same thing. So communities are starting to ask, and that's what our institute is doing, to bring this to people in exactly the kind of questions you're asking, Alex, the practical issues and breaking down the kind of confusing science, because we do need to plan for rising waters. In fact, I like to put it into a positive, that, you know, we must rise with the tide. King tides, these extreme high tides that are driven by the position of the planets, they're getting higher and higher. The reason they're getting higher is because there's more water in the ocean, and that's because the glaciers are melting in Greenland and Antarctica. So we're not seeing the big picture, and we need to, and that's a good function for a nonprofit. So that's what our International Sea Level Institute will do. And we have a basic website. We're still in the process of development, but it's sealevelinstitute.org.
Sealevelinstitute.org. Okay, I will check that out. Now, you have been telling people that sea level rise may be the least politically charged impact of climate change. People who don't seem to care about heat or even replacing fossil fuels do pay attention to rising seas. Talk to us about that, John.
Yes, when I started focusing on this problem back in 2007, I think it was, when I really got focused on the sea level, it was because I realized that as sea level went higher and higher and moved the shoreline inland and put property underwater and investments, that was a message that was nonpartisan. And I could stay out of the political fray, and it didn't matter whether I was on the right or left, that the fact is, no matter what somebody's wealth, they might care about the shoreline moving inland. And I put it in those simple terms. And it's been quite effective, to a degree, by getting it out of the politics and not being associated with the right, left, or even center, and just saying, here are the facts. Because whether you're a very conservative or even libertarian investor, or whether you're a politician on the right side, or a banker, or somebody who just is watching their stocks and where the markets are headed, the idea that sea level will rise foot by foot, and actually has already passed the point of stopping any time this century, tends to get people's attention and be seen as outside of politics. It also appeals to the national security interests and military leaders, and I just try and stay clear of any partisan politics.
Yeah, I guess the biggest naval port in the world at Norfolk, Virginia, could well go under. And I have talked to people who have assessed military awareness of this, and it's high. They know it's coming.
Absolutely. The Naval Station Norfolk, as you say, is not only the world's largest Navy base, but has had for 10 or 20 years now, has had problems with the piers becoming dysfunctional at king tides, let alone storm events. And they spent tens of millions, I bet it's well over $100 million already, grappling with the problem and studying how are they going to deal with this as it gets worse and worse. And it's not just the Navy, it's the Coast Guard, and in fact the Air Force, a lot of airports and Air Force bases are near the water for safety reasons, to not being overpopulations as they take off and land. And they're all having a problem with more and more flooding.
In your presentation to the Royal Institution, you said when the oceans warm, they release carbon dioxide. Now, we've been used to the ocean being a big carbon sink that soaks up our excess pollution, but this sounds like more bad news. How would that work?
It's interesting. The oceans, or the atmosphere carbon level and the ocean temperature, go together over long periods of time. There's two different principles of physics, and it's one of the confusing things, but they move in lockstep with a bit of a delay. When the oceans warm, there's a principle of physics that says the amount of dissolved gas will be less. And you can prove this very simply. Take two bottles of carbonated beverage, club soda or Coke, doesn't matter, and uncap them. And if you warm one, it will go flat. It will have less carbonated dissolved gas than the one that's cool still. And so that's the proof that warmer liquids release gas, and you can actually watch it happen. The converse, that the carbon dioxide in the air will warm the ocean, is this principle of greenhouse gases that was proven in 1859 at the Royal Institution at that same lecture desk that you saw me at in that video. And it's a simple physics principle that's been known for 170 years, that carbon dioxide, even though it's clear, traps heat in a very powerful way. So if we put more carbon dioxide in the air, it traps heat and warms the ocean. And if geothermal or orbital variations of temperature warm the ocean, which is what's happened historically, it will release carbon dioxide. So for two totally different principles of physics, carbon dioxide and temperature will go together over the course of decades and centuries.
In recent interviews, scientists and authors say we may warm another 2 degrees C average mean temperature by the year 2100, taking us up to 3 degrees C warmer than pre-industrial. Now, if I understood what you said in your lecture correctly, that science expects 20 meters higher seas for each increase of 1 degree. And, hey, that would be 40 meters or 131 feet higher seas from that much warming. Surely that cannot possibly happen by 2100. When would the full impact be reached?
Oh, you know, it would be centuries, undoubtedly, and perhaps even some would say thousands of years. So to make this realistic and practical, even though the numbers you said are theoretically correct, I like to point out that in that science environment of the Royal Institution, I was a little more specific than normal, but there is a relationship of sea level to global temperature of 20 meters per degree C, which works out to about 35 feet per degree Fahrenheit. So even though we have already warmed almost a degree C, which would be 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to take centuries to get, you know, anything like that amount of sea level rise. So let's stay focused on this century and back to where we were, that we could be looking at 1 to 3 meters, 2.5 meters of sea level rise this century on our current path. So that's, you know, that's between 3 and 8 feet. And even though that's a range of uncertainty, like preparing for hurricanes or earthquakes in San Francisco or mudslides or avalanches, we should begin preparing for somewhere between 3 and 8 feet of sea level rise. And that's an entirely revolutionary concept in coastal development and architecture and engineering and ports and so on. And the sooner we plan for it cautiously or conservatively, the better.
Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is oceanographer, author, and longtime protector of the seas, John Englander. And you can find him at johnenglander.net. We're talking about the single biggest impact of climate change, rising seas. All right, so John, when it comes to flooding of major cities like New York, London, or Shanghai, can we build our way out of it? How are the sea defenses on the Thames River or at Rotterdam working out?
The defenses on the Thames and in Rotterdam were not built high enough. In both cases, they were designed after the storm of 1953 that killed a few thousand people. Nobody imagined sea level being 10 feet higher, you know, in the next century or two. So they were designed for a much lower threshold. They were mostly designed for storms. To your broader question, that from Shanghai to Calcutta and Copenhagen to Manila, you know, what should we be designing to in these thousands of coastal cities? In some places, we can build seawalls to a degree, but that's not an endless solution. You can't build a 20-foot seawall. And even in places like Miami, which have porous limestone, most places that are built on ancient coral reefs, seawalls wouldn't work at all because the water would just come up deep underground through the porous rock. So different cities will have different solutions. In some places we can have levees, some places we can have those big engineering solutions like Rotterdam and London, as you mentioned. But they need to be evaluated both for the rock structure, the elevation of the land. If the land is very flat, it's only 3 feet high, the options are limited. If the land rises more steeply and it's solid rock, there's other options. But each case needs to have a vulnerability assessment and a design that's appropriate. But the simple thought that we're just going to build higher and higher seawalls is misplaced. We are at some point, when we face 5 or 10 feet of sea level rise, we are going to have to, as I say, move to higher ground, both literally and figuratively. That may mean higher buildings, elevated, it could be floating buildings, or it literally could be moving inland to a higher point. But we're not going to give up the coast. We will always need to be on the coast for shipping and fishing and recreation and beauty and everything. I don't believe as a species that we could ever just live, you know, 10 miles inland. We will always need to be on the coast for practical reasons of working with the ocean for fisheries and shipping.
I remember a few years ago talking with the Maryland professor J. Court Stevenson. It was after Sandy, and he said that for about $10 billion, they could build floodgates to protect the port of New York at least until the year 2100. It's a matter of finding the social will and the political awareness to do it, because really New York hasn't done that. They haven't started that, even though they know it could happen, even though Lower Manhattan was flooded during Sandy.
Well, it's true, and they are marshaling plans to do that and looking at funding sources and designs. But we have to distinguish that base higher sea level, let's just think of even 3 feet higher sea level, is one situation, and that's a permanent rise in water height and therefore trying to push the shoreline inland. On top of that, we get storms and extreme tides. A lot of the solutions are really storm barriers to keep out, you know, the walls of water during a Hurricane Sandy or Katrina-type event, and that's valid. But those solutions are probably not solutions to sea level being 3 feet higher permanently. So we need to think of both. And, we you know, like even unfortunately in warfare and national security, we tend to be fighting the last battle, as the generals say. And designing something for Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Katrina is valid, but it's not the same thing as preparing for sea level normally on a sustained basis being several feet higher. Because when it is higher, it means when the big storm does come to town, even it will be higher. So there's two different situations. There's sustained sea level and then temporary flooding during an event. We have to prepare for both.
John Englander, are you finding governments in Asia are interested in rising seas and adaptation?
Yes. I think, although I haven't been there in a few years, I do know that China is asking the question, and Singapore, for example, and even in Japan, they're becoming more aware of this. I think of all the countries, and perhaps it's easiest and most vulnerable because they're a small island nation, Singapore is perhaps ahead. But I think the advantage that all the Asian cultures have, so China, Japan, Singapore, Korea, is they think longer. They can plan for a century quite naturally because they look back thousands of years in their culture. In the West, particularly in the United States, we think 3 months, a quarterly report, is a long time. And to begin to plan for a century from now is much harder for us. I do sense that Asia has that historical time perspective and probably will be ahead of us. In fact, there are signs of that.
If we need a reference city for incursion by the sea, you recommend an odd choice, San Francisco. How come?
Well, San Francisco is not only a great American city, it tends to be our gateway to the Pacific and Asian cultures for a number of reasons. So it's a very a heterogeneous city culturally, but also it tends to be the city that is the city that has our oldest tide gauges. We have a very good historic record of sea level change in San Francisco. And it's not moving up or down, what we call vertical land movement, like New Orleans or Norfolk are both going down. The land is literally going down, so sea level rise happens faster there. In Alaska, the land is moving upwards, so sea level seems to be falling there. San Francisco, therefore, has a lot of characters I really like. It's a very ethnically diverse city, a very vibrant city, near Silicon Valley. But the giant San Francisco Bay is having problems with flooding and what they call sea level rise. It's not ocean waves so much because the Golden Gate Bridge kind of throttles or stops the big ocean waves from coming into the giant bay. But they are seeing right there on the Embarcadero, the 140-year-old elevation was set 140 years ago, that long 7.5-mile waterfront that many visitors have been to, that's flooding more and more. It's very visual. The waves are coming up over the seawall, and it's because sea level rise is manifesting during these king tide events, and it's happening now about 30 days a year. So being a very iconic U.S. city, it's a great place to see the vulnerability and get away from this belief that, oh, this is just a natural cycle and this isn't a problem, because in the last 10, 20, 30 years, it's become increasingly visible there.
The problem of cities really holds people's attention. So many people live in cities, but we hear less about saltwater incursion into deltas that are heavily populated and farmed. And I think that's going to make the news as millions of people become migrants, or maybe it won't hit the news because it'll happen slowly and farmers just leave their salted fields as they're doing right now in Vietnam. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's saltwater incursion or intrusion, it's often said, and that's where the saltwater is getting into the aquifers and the place we use for fresh water for drinking water, like here in South Florida, but for agricultural as well in coastal areas. So you're absolutely right. It is already having effect. You can see it in these stranded forests And I think it is going to have a big effect. And it's just, it's hard to keep our eyes on it because it gets lost in the storms and the changing rainfall patterns, which could be droughts or heavier rain, both of which happen with a warming ocean, by the way. So it's confusing, but I think it will have a dramatic effect not only on agriculture, but also on drinking water supply as the glaciers melt and recede from the Sierra Nevadas to Asia, Himalayas, and even to South America, to Argentina, that those shrinking glaciers are going to also affect agriculture, just as will rising salt water getting into the water table, as you described.
Okay, suppose we miraculously manage to slash greenhouse gas emissions in the next 10 or 20 years and the renewable energy revolution finally takes off with electric everything. Will the sea stop rising when our emissions stop happening?
No, unfortunately, it will take decades, in fact, centuries, for sea level rise to stop and for even the possibility of reversing it. It will slow, and we need to do everything you just described, which is to slow the emissions and even find ways to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, to slow the warming, to slow the melting ice, to slow the rising sea. That's the first step. It's like if you're speeding down the road and can see you're going to hit the wall on a wet pavement, the first thing is take your foot off the accelerator. And so that's the equivalent. We have to reduce the warming input. But we're not going to immediately stop the car nor stop a supertanker in its tracks when you pull back on the throttle. So we have to do both. We have to pull back on the warming force that's melting the ice and raising the sea level, but we also have to recognize, as you just suggested, that it won't stop immediately. In fact, it will be decades, in fact, perhaps centuries, before sea level rise stops because we've warmed the oceans already 1 degree Celsius, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit, and we're on target to double that or triple that now. And that warming is going to translate into smaller glaciers and ice sheets, which means higher sea level, which means the shoreline is going to tend to move inland. So we've got to do both. Slow the warming, begin preparing for strange weather events, extreme weather events, heavy rainfall, droughts, fires, and also for higher sea level that can't be stopped in its tracks.
John, you tell audiences rising sea level could be the biggest economic driver for this century. I'm a little bit more pessimistic. I'm wondering whether we will be able to rebuild or adapt rather than just lose ground or run away or even crash as an economy. How could it be a good thing in a way if we get our act together?
Well, great question. I don't think you're wrong, Alex, I must tell you. But, you know, to move forward, we have to see light at the end of the tunnel. We have to see the glass half full as well as half empty. And I'm always clear to say that, but there is truth in it. If we think about the fact that sea level is going to be 5 feet higher, whether it happens by 2060 or 2160, but at some point, as soon as that becomes clear, and it becomes clear we can't stop it, even though we must try and slow it, we are going to have to build or engineer a new coastal communities and ports and everything all over the world. And at the simplest level, if you think about it, let's just say that sea level is, you know, headed 5 feet higher and we've got a century's notice. Once that becomes clear, and whether it be Bangladesh and Vietnam or New York City or Miami or Tampa or Jacksonville, Copenhagen, cities we don't normally think of, we are going to spend trillions of dollars adapting or relocating or reengineering on all sorts of things. And it's not optional. I mean, most things in this world we have some choice in. Because we've already warmed the oceans and melting the ice sheets and glaciers, which will raise sea level, the truth is we are going to have to spend trillions of dollars adapting to that, both as either defenses or relocations or engineering marvels of raising things up. Whatever it is, that driving force of the melting ice on Greenland and Antarctica, raising sea level foot by foot, will cause us to spend trillions of dollars. Now, we'll lose trillions of dollars to the sea, but from a simple financial concept on a balance sheet, if you would, take it very simply as an investor would or a bank or even a country, we may write off $1 trillion to flooded properties, but we're going to spend that much to create new value because this isn't going to kill people, generally speaking. And because it happens slowly enough, we will adapt. But we have no choice. If the ocean is going to be 3 feet higher, it's not like we have an option as to whether to deal with it or not. It's going to become the one inescapable truth that as sea level is 5 feet higher or headed there, we are going to have to re-engineer every coastal community in the world and up tidal rivers and through the marshlands and et cetera. It's seeing the glass half full. It's saying, as terrible as this will be, there's an upside, and those that can see it early will not only profit, but will help us all adapt. And I see that as a positive.
Are you planning another book to follow up on High Tide on Main Street?
You're kind to ask. I'm halfway through writing Moving to Higher Ground. It's the sequel, and it talks about some of the things we've just covered in this program. It should be out in 2020. If people sign up on my website, johnenglander.net, they'll certainly get notice of it. Hopefully, it'll be an even bigger success. High Tide on Main Street did well. But, yes, thank you for asking, and I'm excited. And it really will cover a lot of the direction that you've thoughtfully asked me on this program on EcoShock.
We have been speaking with John Englander, an oceanographer, longtime leader of several key ocean conservation organizations, and now founder of the International Sea Level Institute. You can find more links to John's work in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and of course, as he says, at his website, johnenglander.net. Thank you so much for taking your time to spread this important message with us.
Well, thank you, Alex. You're a great participant in this. You're very educated, and you're a good interviewer. So thank you for your diligence and staying on top of these issues and bringing them to the public.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Yes, the climate has tipped. In the past 2 years, my own home and studio was threatened by wildfires. I hope that doesn't happen this summer. This concludes my run of 45 new Radio EcoShock productions this season. It has been a wild ride for sure. I feel a little guilty leaving my post for a couple of months while the climate fire roars on all over the world. But I need to reground myself in my garden, to kayak down the river, to live as though I don't know the future at all. Then I'll be back with you first thing in September with more Radio EcoShock. In the meantime, I am providing all stations and listeners a special selection of the best interviews from the past 13 seasons of the show. Keep in mind, some great science going all the way back to 2006 is still need-to-know information. Of course, you'll hear some classics like Professor Tim Garrett saying, "Civilization is a heat engine," which can only save itself by crashing. I'm thinking of Dr. Peter Ward's work on rising seas and past catastrophes in the climate. We will have biologists and all the great scientists and speakers. Feel free to charge up your iPod or computer for deep summer listening. Radio EcoShock can help you understand this strange new present and prepare for the unexpected future. My thanks to all supporters and listeners all over the world. We do have listeners in every major city on every continent. You are in Spain and Singapore and Baltimore and Winnipeg and Mumbai and London. Feel free to write me over the summer with your ideas and experiences on the ground. I will be keeping my eyes on the pulse of the planet to leap back into the fray next September. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org.